From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Wisconsin's Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin explains why she voted to increase funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Then, on Veterans Day, we talk with a healthcare reporter about why the attempts to privatize the Veterans Health Administration are a bad idea.
You either have a very well-run, high-quality, cost-effective system like the VHA is, or you send people into the American private sector healthcare system, which is market-driven and profit-driven, the most ineffective in terms of cost and quality in the industrialized world.
And a Milwaukee nonprofit, Guitars for Vets, has grown from one chapter here to 43 chapters across the country. But they're not done yet.
There's 25 million plus veterans in the United States at any time, and over 1 million with PTSD. We've been able to help 4,000 of them, but we've got work to do.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. It's Veterans Day, a national holiday that recognizes those who served in our armed forces. Coming up a little later in the show, we will talk with a healthcare journalist about the troubling efforts to dismantle the Veterans Health Administration. And we'll learn about a local effort to help vets with PTSD that's gone national. But first, we'll turn our attention to the Great Lakes. The five Great Lakes, Superior, Michigan, Huron, Erie, and Ontario, contain more than 20% of the world's surface freshwater. But the basin is also plagued with challenges, from algae bloom to invasive species. A special federal fund called the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, or GLRI, gives resources to communities throughout the region to tackle aquatic issues. And last week, an amendment was introduced that would increase the 2020 GLRI funding by $9 million. One of the legislators who signed on is Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin. She tells Lake Effect Susan Bentz that, in her mind, Wisconsin and its waters are inseparable and critically important.
When I think about what makes Wisconsin unique and special, one of the first things I think about is our water resources. Even when I was representing a city council and county board district in downtown Madison, Madison downtown is an isthmus between two lakes. And it is particularly gorgeous because of that. And as I had the opportunity to represent larger districts in the state of Wisconsin, the challenges that our waterways face became more and more apparent, and how we all have to work together to attack those. Certainly, when I ran for the United States Senate thought about what makes Wisconsin, Wisconsin. You know, we have, except for our southern border, which is a straight line across, our borders are defined by water. We have an east coast, which is Lake Michigan. We have a north coast, which is Lake Superior. And we have a west coast, which is the St. Croix River, followed as it flows into the Mississippi River. And it is so much a part of who we are as Wisconsinites, but the challenges abound. And when you think about the Great Lakes as being the world's largest body of fresh water, bodies of fresh water, we need to protect them. And I see them being challenged more than they've ever been challenged before, especially with climate change.
So when you were elected to the Senate, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was, you know, in full swing. It's about 10 years old. What do you see as having been accomplished, and point to perhaps an example of the importance of what can be achieved with this kind of funding, or what is achieved?
Yes. Well, it was very clear that the Great Lakes needed a master plan, and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is the program that we utilize to do all sorts of projects that protect the health and well-being of the Great Lakes. Most of that activity happens at the local level, where projects need to occur and need funding to make them happen. It can be local units of government or local nonprofits, oftentimes volunteers. It can involve everything from restoration of habitat, creating resiliency in our coasts, our lakeshores, and it can include cleaning up rivers that will ultimately flow into the Great Lakes so that they don't deposit pollutants and other harmful things. It can involve our battle against harmful algal blooms that impact the ability to enjoy the Great Lakes for swimmers or canoers or people who like to go angling on the Great Lakes. All the way to commercial fisheries. All of the things that we're seeing can have not only a big environmental hit, negative impact, but also a major economic impact. And so through the funding of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative over the past several years, we've been able to really improve conditions, but we're not keeping up with climate change. I think one particular example would be up in Marinette and improvements locally in their harbor that cleaned up that area so that you would not see further contamination and pollution going into Lake Michigan at that point. But that would be one of many, many Wisconsin examples of where funds have been used.
So let's talk a little bit about dollars and cents. Over the time of its existence, funding has been challenged. Where do things stand now, and how much of a difference would this additional $9 million to the fund make?
So there has been, in recent years, fairly steady funding, no increases in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, of about $300 million per year. Because of the impact of climate change, we are we believe on a bipartisan basis that we need to up our commitment to get on top of that, to tackle some of the damage that we're seeing because of climate change. And so I worked in a bipartisan basis with members of the Great Lakes region to secure an additional $9 million, bringing the total for the Senate recommendation up to $310 million. In the House, it's $320 million. So we may ultimately, when we see compromise between the two houses, see somewhere in between those two. While that's a modest increase over the sort of base level funding that we've been seeing, it expresses a bipartisan intent to step up our efforts. And hand in hand with this effort this year to increase the funding is a bipartisan bill that reauthorizes the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and expresses an intent to sizably increase the commitment gradually on an annual basis until we're up to about $475 million per year. That, again, is a bipartisan bill. You mentioned the challenge that we've seen in funding this initiative. That challenge has really come from this administration, which in every budget that the Trump administration has introduced has slashed funding, close to zeroing it out. And in one year, I think it was a 90% cut, and we've seen similar proposals out of this administration with each successive budget. So it's been up to Congress to knit together a bipartisan response to that, and we have. And it's why it's so important to show the commitment we have to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
So what is the timing now, Senator Baldwin, for people who are concerned or have growing concern about our Great Lakes and its restoration? What are times or dates that they should stay tuned to?
Yeah, so the bill in which this funding exists is now going to be conferenced between the House and the Senate. Each House has passed their respective versions. Those discussions are underway right now. The looming deadlines, we have a continuing resolution that expires on November 21st. It would be great if we can resolve the differences between the two houses by then. In my mind, there's no reason why we can't. There's also discussion of extending the continuing resolution for a couple more weeks if it takes that long to resolve differences between the two houses.
So for anyone for whom continuing resolution is a new...
Yes.
It's foreign to the vocabulary. Explain that a bit, if you would.
I will. So every year, the Congress is required to pass appropriations measures that fund all of the programs of government that aren't funded by, like an earmarked tax. So the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is one such program. The federal fiscal year goes from October 1st to September 30th of the following year. And if the Congress has not passed new spending measures, new appropriations, by that date, September 30th, government would shut down if we were not to pass a continuing resolution. So we passed the continuing resolution when September 30th hit, to extend the time that Congress has to finish these measures. The new date of expiration is November 21st, and we hope that we will have several of the appropriations bills passed into law by then, and that we, will resolve the rest of our work in short order. That's always what we're trying to do.
So you mentioned bipartisan support. Is it a tougher sell outside the basin? I mean, I can imagine that your counterparts from neighboring states in the Great Lakes understand the value of what's at stake here for the region. But beyond that, is it a more difficult sell throughout the country to get these things in motion?
I think that there is a healthy recognition about the importance of the Great Lakes, even for senators who represent states that are not in the Great Lakes Basin. We're seeing the challenges that climate change brings in all of our waterways. And it's not just climate change, but, certainly there's other reasons why we're seeing water contamination. But climate change is hastening some of the challenges. And so in recognition of the importance of this freshwater body or, set of lakes, I think we have been able to build strong bipartisan support for their protection. And people recognize that what we learn from protecting the Great Lakes can be applied elsewhere too. And so there's those indirect benefits.
Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin is a member of the bipartisan Senate Great Lakes Task Force. Baldwin talked with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz about water issues facing Wisconsin beyond protecting the Great Lakes. You'll find that conversation as well as more information about the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative at WUWM.com. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with author and journalist Suzanne Gordon about the health of the Veterans Health Administration and the efforts to discredit it. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It's Veterans Day, a day where we honor the service of the country's more than 18 million living veterans. There'll be parades and speeches and lots of applause. But our next guest says that one of the key players in veterans services, the Veterans Health Administration, is slowly being gutted. Suzanne Gordon is an award-winning author and journalist who writes about healthcare. She spent the last few years focusing on the VA system, and her latest book is called The Battle for Veterans Healthcare. Gordon says the dominant narrative about VA healthcare, both in Congress and in much of the media, is that it's irredeemably broken and it offers substandard care. But she says, no, on the contrary, the VA offers veterans some of the best coordinated and often cutting-edge healthcare in the country. We reached Gordon via Skype at her home in the Bay Area to ask her why the negative narrative about the VA persists.
Because there are very strong forces, notably the conservative billionaire Koch brothers, Concerned Veterans for America, the Trump administration, the Mar-a-Lago group, the hospital industry, that are really kind of circling like vultures because there is a $90 billion pot of gold in the Veterans Health Administration budget that they would like to capture. So they are really working very hard to discredit both government and the Veterans Health Administration, which it's not just my research, it's research that's been published in the New England Journal of Medicine by the RAND Corporation, by the American Medical Association, et cetera, where we have countless studies that show that the VA, the Veterans Health Administration, delivers often equal or superior care to the private sector. Even the famous wait time delays that are supposed to be happening in the VHA, the Veterans Health Administration, are way worse in the private sector, and they've been pretty much remedied in the VA. So it's really interesting to me, Bonnie, that people, particularly people who are liberals or to the left of center, don't believe what they read in the papers about single-payer health care or the ACA or Social Security or whatever, but they believe what they read in the papers about the VA. And basically, even the liberal media has adopted this narrative, and it's very disturbing because nothing could be further than the truth.
Yeah, there's this constant drumbeat to privatize healthcare for veterans. And like you say, there's a lot of money at stake there. And certainly the Mission Act, which was passed into law earlier this year, I think is a result of that pressure. Would you agree?
Oh, totally. I mean, the Mission Act is a bill that was supported, sadly, by way too many Democrats. And it is a bill that outsources care of veterans to the private sector. And I and many other people, I work with a group called the Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute. We warned very, very strongly that the private sector can't handle veteran patients. Not only it doesn't know about their complex, very specific medical and mental health needs, but there's just not the capacity. I mean, I don't know about Wisconsin and Milwaukee, but in the Bay Area, it's really difficult to find a primary care doctor. 55% of American counties, all of them rural, have no social worker, psychiatrist, or psychologist. So where are people going to get helped? And you're putting veterans in competition with non-veteran patients, and that's really not a very good idea. It's certainly not a good idea for veterans because private sector providers don't understand the difference between, say, normal type 2 diabetes and Agent Orange-related diabetes or asthma and burn pit exposure respiratory problems that service members have from having been in the recent combats in the Middle East. So this is a really bad idea, and we just have a new report out. The New York Times reported yesterday that the Mission Act, the third-party insurance company administrators that were hired for a lot of money to set up these networks that veterans could go to, that there just aren't people signing up for these networks because there's not enough providers, they're not willing to accept the pay, and also, quite frankly, a lot of them just don't want to deal with the complexity of veteran patients.
one of the things, you know, I went to the VA website to look at what it says about the Mission Act, and the quote on the first page says the Mission Act will strengthen the nationwide VA healthcare system by empowering veterans with more healthcare options. And you know, I know the VA has traditionally sent veterans to community partners that offered services the VA didn't, like mammograms, before women veterans were fully integrated into the system. So were veterans really lacking in options, or is that just sort of doublespeak?
Well, that's part of the Orwellian doublespeak of choice. And the quote that you gave, Bonnie, is a perfect example. You don't strengthen a system by sending people out of the system. You strengthen the system by strengthening the system, by putting resources into the system. Now they're taking resources out of the system to pay private sector providers. In one VA where I talked to the medical director, I was told that in 2018 they spent $20 million or something like that on private sector care, whereas in the last 3 months of 2019, they spent $53 million. That's a sevenfold increase in resources going out of the VA. And that's just not possible. I mean, you can't sustain a system with that kind of shift of patients or resources. It's also important in a healthcare system, the way you maintain skill and expertise is by seeing more patients, not less. So if one of the things they're trying to do with the Mission Act is send more and more surgical care, more and more procedures like colonoscopies and so forth out into the private sector, because the private sector isn't interested in the long-term maintenance of chronically mentally ill or physically ill veterans. I mean, they're not interested in the long-term maintenance of chronically mentally ill or physically ill non-veteran patients. They want the high-cost episodic procedures. But the problem is that those procedures, I mean, your colonoscopy or your gallbladder operation exists in a whole body that's connected to all kinds of problems. Let me give you an example. In the Milwaukee VA, a PTSD psychologist was telling me about an instance where an Iraq vet needed gallbladder surgery and they were sent to the VA to get the surgery, and the guy really lost it on the ward, on the unit. The surgeon called the psychologist, who was working in the same system, in the same facility. They share the same chart. And he said, "What should I do?" And she told him how to deal with the patient effectively. And then she walked over and saw the patient. That would never happen in the private sector. So you can't divide up the operation from the mental health problems the patient is having from the other physical health problems that the patient is having. It doesn't work that way in healthcare.
You talked about cost. Again, the VA is portrayed as wasteful of taxpayer monies, and it doesn't seem that they are as they are portrayed to be. Is that also fair?
Oh, it's ridiculous, the idea that the VA is wasteful. I mean, we have a private sector system where we spend over $2 trillion on healthcare in this country, and almost half of it goes down the toilet in marketing and administration and CEO salaries. I mean, the VA is incredibly cost effective. It takes care of sicker, older, poorer patients who have many more healthcare problems way less expensively than the private sector. I mean, if you want to see your costs not just triple or quadruple, but absolutely astronomically increase, then send veterans into the private sector. And what's going to happen, sadly, is that the taxpayer is not going to be willing to shoulder this astronomical burden of costs. And so we're going to see services cut, or we're going to see eligibility rules becoming more stricter, and fewer veterans are going to be eligible, because you either have a very well-run, high-quality, cost-effective system like the VHA is, or you send people into the private sector, which is the American private sector healthcare system, which is market-driven and profit-driven, is the most ineffective in terms of cost and quality in the industrialized world.
Going back to the first question that I had for you, why does this story persist? And it seems like that there's a whole bunch of people who are kind of in it together to make sure this fails.
They really want to kill the Veterans Health Administration. They want to starve it of resources. They're not filling the 45,000 or more vacancies that exist. The secretary of the VA says he isn't interested in filling those vacancies, even though he is statutorily obligated to staff the agency. You have a president who is committed to the extent he understands anything to privatization. You have advisors like the Koch brothers, Darren Selnick of the Concerned Veterans for America. And let me say something else that's really important here, Bonnie. One of the things that is fueling this whole debate is the VHA is an excellent example of, it's not quite a single payer system, but it's a publicly funded national health system that works. And the reason why many of these right-wing ideologues are attacking the VHA is because they do not want to see Medicare for all or any kind of health care for all in this country. And they are working assiduously to tarnish the reputation of the only really sort of socialist healthcare system that we have in this country, one that works. And they are determined to make sure that it doesn't work, or at least that the public thinks it doesn't work when in fact it works extremely well. And really, in my view, it shouldn't be Medicare for all. It should be VA for all, because Medicare is a payer, not a system, and the VA is a system. And that's why they deliver better mental health care and better coordinated care and better primary care and better end-of-life care and better geriatric care and better nursing home care. And it's all in the studies.
So what about veterans themselves? I'm sure you've talked to many. How do they feel about the system that is there to serve them?
Well, the people who are in the VHA and who get help from the VA, they very much support it. And most veterans want the VA to be there as an option. And sadly, many don't understand that this quote-unquote choice legislation or the Mission Act doesn't really give them a choice, because its intent is to eliminate the VHA as one of the choices. And so really, veterans have always had the choice to go into the private sector if the VA doesn't provide the service, as you mentioned before. And there are all kinds of veterans groups that are extremely concerned about this, the Disabled American Veterans. I believe that many of the veterans service organizations like the American Legion and so forth have made very poor choices themselves when they supported the Mission Act. And I think they did this because they felt that they had to be at the table. They had to be reasonable players. Many Democrats are being hoodwinked into supporting some of these initiatives because they're afraid to appear anti-veteran. The Trump administration is pushing something now called the Improve Well-Being Act that is going to try to outsource mental health care in the name of suicide prevention, if you really want to prevent veteran suicide, you should actually let all veterans into the VA, and you should do more marketing of the VA and marketing of the services it provides. I mean, you see in Milwaukee advertisements for local hospital systems. You never see any for the incredible services that the Milwaukee VA provides, because the VA isn't allowed to spend money on that, and it should be.
So what are some steps that people can do to help ensure that the VA remains in place? Is there something average citizens can do?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that people can absolutely call their congresspeople and say that they want the VA to be fully funded and fully staffed. I think that people have to understand that when Secretary Wilkie, the Secretary of the VA, says that they oppose privatization, they're really saying the opposite. Privatization isn't just closing all the facilities and laying everybody off tomorrow. It's starving the system of resources and outsourcing care to the private sector. I think that people can understand that Medicare for All would be good for veterans and their families and communities because it would actually take privatization of the VA off the table, because you couldn't be depleting the resources of the VA to pay for private sector care if everyone was insured. I think people need to really petition Congress to give the VA more resources to market and its services, and give out and do more outreach to veterans to explain the services that are available. And I think we also, in the richest country in the world, can do away with the kind of eligibility requirements that mean that half of the veteran population is not able to get care at the VA because they're essentially not eligible. And we can afford for not that much more in cost to give every veteran services at a Veterans Health Administration facility.
You're not a veteran yourself, so why is protecting and advancing the VA so important to you?
Well, I've been studying private sector care for 35 or more years, plus I'm 74, and I'm a patient. I have a great health insurance, quote unquote, and I will never get the kind of care the VA delivers at its best, and almost routinely, to veterans, never, because they don't do coordinated, integrated care in the private sector. I have to be my own care integrator. I just had cataract surgery. My primary care doctor doesn't even know because I haven't gotten around to telling him yet. They don't talk to each other. And so I really see the VA as a model for the kind of care we all could get. When I was writing my book, Wounds of War, I followed palliative care and end-of-life care, the end-of-life care team in one VA facility in San Francisco, and I was just stunned by the extraordinary way that they helped veterans and families navigate the last days of life in ways that our healthcare system seems to be incapable of doing. So I'm in this for veterans because I think we owe veterans the best healthcare system that we can give them. And we have that system. Of course, it can be improved, but it's pretty darned good. And I think we also owe it to the rest of Americans to learn from the Veterans Health Administration, not dismantle it.
Well, Suzanne Gordon, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Suzanne Gordon is an award-winning author and journalist who writes about healthcare. For the past 3 years, she's focused on veterans' healthcare, and her most recent book is called The Battle for Veterans' Healthcare: Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care. We spoke with her via Skype. Gordon is in Milwaukee today to speak at the Veterans for Peace event, Reclaiming Armistice Day. It's taking place at the Central United Methodist Church in Milwaukee. It starts at 7. There is a link to more information at WUWM.com. A local nonprofit organization that's been working with veterans for the past dozen years has seen its program expand into 43 states. We'll learn more about Guitars for Vets when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about some of the cutting-edge treatment the VA system offers its veteran population. But as comprehensive as VA care can be, it can't do everything. So often, nonprofit organizations step in to work with the VA. We featured some of those local groups on Lake Effect, like Feast of Crispian. They're doing important work with vets. Another such group is Guitars for Vets, co-founded a dozen years ago by Marine Corps veteran Dan Van Buskirk and musician and guitar instructor Patrick Nedesheim. Guitars for Vets provides guitars and guitar lessons free to any veteran who's interested. And as Dan, who suffers from combat-related PTSD, will tell you, what one guitar can do is pretty astounding. Dan and Patrick join me in the studio now to tell us more. Dan and Pat, it is a pleasure to have you back in the studio.
Yes,
it's only been a dozen years.
Thank you.
You know what, Bonnie? It's barely a tick of the clock when we talk geology.
That's true. Yeah. In terms of Earth time and cosmological time, you know, we just saw each other yesterday. But it has been 12 years since we first talked about Guitars for Vets. And you reminded me before we turned on the microphone that that was your first radio interview. I think when we talked, you had barely begun.
Yeah. I was actually a very young man when we first talked, as well as Dan. And I believe we had one chapter, and that was at Zablocki VA right here in Milwaukee.
And so I assume things have grown a little bit in the intervening years.
Yes, we have expanded by more than 110 chapters throughout the United States. It's pretty mind-blowing, and, you know, we've taken a few steps up the mountainside, but when you think that there's 25 million-plus veterans in the United States at any time, and over 1 million with PTSD. We've been able to help 4,000 of them, but even if 5% of that 1 million would like our program, it's another 50,000. So we've got work to do.
Dan, you're the veteran in the group. What was it about the need that you saw that made you think guitars are going to help?
Well, as a vet struggling with PTSD from combat, I needed harmony in my life, and I needed to refine myself from the triggers of war. It's a constant refinement, lifelong refinement, to lubricating that PTSD survival brain so that the triggers of war and trauma can't attach to it so easily, so that we catch that. And with the guitar, we're replacing those sounds of battle, those sounds of you're not enough, you didn't save your buddy, with a daily practice and a daily habit of bringing harmonious notes into our life. So Aristotle said, excellence isn't an act, it's daily habits that we form. And one thing Pat really got through to me, because I didn't have a lot of self-confidence with the guitar, he said, it's not anything but practice, just play. And when we play the guitar, even simple three chords, it's just such a beautiful sound. And like a rifle, we're holding it close to our body, but it's reaching our soul, which a rifle can't do. Completely different instruments.
Had you played before you had gone into the service?
No, not at all, before the service, right.
Yeah. So this was a new thing for
new
you.
Thing,
yeah.
Yes.
You know, people have talked about how music, you know, soothes the savage beast. Music does a lot of things because it reaches, it's kind of doesn't need words. And it goes to a place that allows people to communicate and heal in a way that other things don't. And so when Pat, you and I first talked back 12 years ago, you know, one of the things that so excited me about this, particularly in this population of people who are dealing with PTSD from combat, that, you know, you're using something so fundamental to being human to try to help people.
Absolutely. I do not believe they have yet found a culture on this planet that does not have some form of music indigenous to it. So it is, I think, as innately human as you see religion is, some form of spirituality, let's put it that way, within every culture. This is a piece of it. This is a conduit to the higher self.
Right. And we carry around the first instrument, you know, our singing, our ability to make beautiful sound.
Yeah, the body is an instrument for sure. And, I always joke, my brother is a drummer in my band. You know, he hits stuff with sticks. You know, that's where it all started. I mean, we can make sound, and there is something attractive to that that helped us refine it as a species.
So when you first started, and I know it was here, and it was here in Milwaukee, was the plan all along to try to get it into every VA in the country?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, not only in every VA, but just simply to make it accessible to every U.S. military veteran that would find what we do beneficial.
And do you find that the VAs from 12 years ago to now, are people more or less or the same receptive to having this kind of program?
Well, I would say, you know, having over 100 chapters in the U.S. does help because we have some street cred. And the vast majority of music therapists and rec therapists at VAs would like us to come in and help because there's usually only one, maybe two rec therapists. And we're not music therapists. So I put that out there right away. These folks go through years of schooling and the psychology that's involved. We show up and we teach guitar and we listen to our brothers and sisters and we work on cultivating joy. But to get back to your point, Bonnie, the vast majority welcomes us with open arms. There's always a few that, for whatever reason, feel a bit threatened by this, but that is not our intent. Our intent is to augment the services that are provided.
And so, Dan, I understand you helped co-found this, but then you kind of went and did some other things.
Yes.
And then have come back.
I think it takes a village. So I co-founded Hounds and Vets Empowered Now Haven, and we help vets with service dogs. We help teach them how to train service dogs. And it helps the dog because the dog usually comes from the Humane Society and the dog's been dumped out in the highway somewhere in Tennessee or some other state. And
here.
And it has PTSD, so they understand each other and they work really well as a team.
Well, I love the idea of animals and music together, too.
I
think
do
that's
too.
A wonderful combination.
Yeah. My Labrador Retriever always lays next to me no matter how bad I play the guitar.
Loves you anyway.
Yeah, he gets it.
As long as you don't play those notes that make them twitch, you
oh,
know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and the animals have done a lot for music. You know, House of the Rising Sun, We Got to Get Out of This Place. Those
yeah.
are all animals.
Oh, those animals, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I don't think any of those are lying next to to Dan. Yeah, I don't think so. Well, maybe they are.
I try
you know?
To keep him on a pretty tight leash.
Yes.
Speaking of animals.
Yeah. And so what made you come back?
I am always asking how I can demonstrate a purpose of helping a traumatized community. And when we came back from Vietnam for 30 years, we didn't know anything about trauma or PTSD. So we struggled. We blamed ourselves. We felt like we weren't enough to save our teammates, to save our marriages. We went through hell with that because we couldn't get treatment. So my thought is, the Vietnam vets have led the way. They have led the way on trauma work. And I want Milwaukee to lead the way in a traumatized community. Let's take point. Let's go face the landmines and the unfriendlies of the triggers of trauma, and let's get something done right here, right now. We can do it.
Well, and you have. And you're in 100 different communities now. How are you getting funding? What is it, 501c3?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're a nonprofit?
That is correct.
Yeah.
We get funding by working 12 to 14 hours a day.
Asking for grants and donations?
Yeah, out there begging.
Yeah.
We've had some corporate response, but the majority of it comes from people like us sitting right here, you know, $10, $20 at a time. The folks that don't have a lot to give tend to be the ones that give the most. And why that is, I really don't know. So we're still looking for that angel philanthropist to come through here after 12 years. We have an opportunity to be running 1,000 chapters, you know, in every state. Right now we're in 43 states. We have the infrastructure there, but we just need to build more of that, meaning hire some more folks. What people don't understand, some, is that folks can't, I mean, I did this, Dan and I did this for free for 7 years, but not everybody is that unique.
I was going to say dedicated or able. You know, a lot of people can't, you know, do something that takes that kind of effort without getting paid for it.
Absolutely. And I totally understand that. And we were in a position where we could figure out some way to get by on, you know, ramen noodles and lentils.
Yeah.
Sea rations.
Sea rations, yeah. Well, they still have a stockpile of those somewhere, I think. Make sure you have your hot sauce.
Because
it's the only thing that makes it palatable. Do the guys get to keep the guitars?
Yes, after 10 free, this is all free for the vet, private lessons. And during these 10 lessons, they're using a guitar that we get donated by the community. So we're always looking for guitar donations. But after those 10 lessons, when they graduate, they get a brand new, at this point, we're using Yamaha acoustic guitars and all of the accessories, the stand, the bag, the string, straps, picks, tuner, everything you need to enjoy the instrument. That costs guitars for vets $200 for the whole graduation packs. And then the vets go on to group lessons where the teamwork and the camaraderie is established, and they put together bands to perform out. Boy, that does a heck of a lot for the self-esteem. And it just continues to pay itself forward as more people in the community see the results of what we're putting together here.
So what kind of data have you gotten back from the various chapters in terms of the healing portion of it? Are you getting reports from counselors saying these folks are doing so much better and here's how we can prove that?
Yeah, and Dan can speak to this too, but I would say the majority of the reports come directly from the students themselves, and they say this saved my life. So it's really hard, Bonnie, to put a number on how many people didn't take their life today.
Right.
I mean, you could just figure out the population on Earth and at one given moment and say that. And I always tell folks that they saved their lives. Maybe we gave them a tool.
Yeah.
We threw them a life preserver because you can't stop somebody, but you can inspire and encourage and let them, you know, find that spark that's still within them. And we just throw a little gasoline on that. But what's your experience, Dan?
Well, my experience, I was in a Marine recon team. We walked point for the infantry to find out where the enemy base camps were. So we had a fair amount of combat under our belts. And my personal experience is a trauma dies very hard. So it's a lifetime of work to get better. And it requires of us not to get too wrapped up in healing, but in learning how to refine our thoughts so that when the untrue thoughts about ourselves come in, the disharmony, we replace them with harmony. And the guitar is an inroad into that because it takes focus to practice with your strumming hand, your fretboard hand, and coordinate all that. So the stinking thinking, as the Marines call it, doesn't have a chance to get in. We don't have time to delve into the past or the future. We're right here in the present. And that, I wouldn't say that's healing, but it's teaching us how to think better and how capturing, like Patrick said, joy. It's linking us up with our soul. And war tears the soul out of people because it's so incredibly brutal and extreme that it's not right for human beings to be in war. So we get to turn that around.
How has your guitar playing changed over the years since you started doing this?
Well, I'm still working at it. I'm learning how to get my timing down, my rhythm, and the chords have always been fairly easy for me. So it's never like, oh, I've got it. You just keep, it's like Aristotle said, you just work on your habits and you practice every day. It shows up in feeling more of that peace and harmony in your life that music brings. It's really special to create our own music rather than, you know, depending on. The guitar is something you can take anywhere with you. You can backpack with it. You can take it in your car. Mm-hmm. You can go to a park someplace quietly and play it. When we're feeling anxiety, that's a good time to play the guitar.
Pull the guitar out. Yeah.
If I'm feeling anxiety, I don't work with my dog because he picks up on the anxiety. So I can go to my guitar as a tool and play that and then come back to my dog when the anxiety is not there.
And, you know, we can't finish this interview without mentioning, you know, on the dark side of things, when Dan and I started this organization, the suicide rate was 18 a day. And that blew me away. I was thinking 18 a month, which is horrible. No, it's a day. Then it came up to 22, and we have a lot of organizations that deal with the number 22. And what's it at now, Dan?
24.
24. I mean, this is absolutely unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And our brothers and sisters who are taking their lives are doing it because they're in agony. This has nothing to do about, you know, somebody taking the easy way out. They just want the pain to stop. And what we can do by getting these folks in the program, some of the people we work with, this is all they have. That's mm-hmm. it. They want to come back and work on those guitar chords. Now, there's other modalities that can do that, but I use the term pays itself forward. When you're playing the guitar, people gather around. You just walk down the street with a guitar in the bag. It's like walking a dog. People say, hey, do you play in a band? Do you play? It's a wonderful social catalyst.
I think one of the things I most admire about our guitar teachers is that they're working with vets that have experienced homelessness, all kinds of issues. They're walking point right out there in the middle of the trauma field. Our first organization was in the domiciliary, and that's where the vets come in that are experiencing homelessness and drug problems. Of course, drugs. Young people, 18-year-old brain, it has to turn to some kind of coping mechanism to handle war, to lose your teammates. And just think, they come in without a home, and they come in with all the trauma, and they've got a group right there offering them some joy, some happiness, a free guitar, and sticking with them through the process afterwards. And when you walk into Guitarist for Vets chapters, there's always a lot of laughter, a lot of good. Everybody's pretty happy, and it's the kind of change these guys need, these men and women need.
Well, I want to thank you for doing the work. It's hard, and those numbers make it hard. But, you know, it sounds like in the dozen years since we last talked that a lot of good has happened, and I want to thank you both for coming in and telling us about it.
Peace.
Thank you.
Marine veteran Dan Van Buskirk and musician and guitar instructor Patrick Nettesheim co-founded Guitars for Vets in Milwaukee a dozen years ago. The organization now has chapters in 43 states. You can find out more about what they do at wuwm.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. So glad to have you with us today. A special thanks to all the veterans in Wisconsin and beyond. A heartfelt tip of the hat to all of you. Another edition of Lake Effect comes your way tomorrow at 10, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Join us then.